Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats. I'm your host, expert layman Matt Goodwin, and per the usual, I am joined by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. Joining us for this installment, all the way from the Pacific Northwest, is Michael Ojeda, baseball aficionado and Twitter king. We have so much to talk about on this episode, but before we get started with all of that, Mikey, how are things on the left coast?
I'm good. I feel like it's cliche every time I say this, but this is one of like two or three podcasts on the Pitcherless Network that I've like explicitly wanted to be on, and now I'm here. So I'm happy to be here with you guys.
Well, we're psyched to have you for sure. There's a reason you're in high demand all around, and everybody's asking you to be on their pods. Alex, checking in with you down there in DC. How are things?
Things are swell. It was warm out today, and I got to sit on my patio outside and not do work, and it was really fun.
That's pretty good.
That's a good
I hope day. I'm conveying as exciting as that it actually is.
Yeah, it was pretty nice up here. I'm in New England, and it was a pretty nice day here as well. It's a nice change of pace. It was cold for a while. We still got a little snow hanging around, fighting the spring, but hopefully we'll have that nice turnaround and be able to go outside and do fun outside things a little bit more often in the near future.
Mikey, is it raining in Seattle? I want to ask this before we get too far off.
No, it wasn't today. It's actually beautiful.
Oh, okay, good. Good, good.
I have to say, Seattle is one of my favorite cities. Boston is my favorite city by far.
Really?
Visited. Yeah, it's just a vibe. I know Boston, sometimes the vibe in Boston is not the right thing historically. But in terms of like the feel, the comfort, Paris felt like that to me. And then when I got out to Seattle, it felt very, very comfortable. There are other cities around the world I enjoy very much, like New York. I love New York City, but it's just a different feel. It's a different vibe. Seattle's definitely one of my favorite places that I've been to.
Yeah.
So speaking of, one of the things that you like to share with people on the Twitters is the local food. What's your favorite thing of the moment? What's the flavor of the week here?
So I posted a picture of this, but I would say easily like the best thing that I've had in the past long while was a suavemente, like Puerto Rican Elvis, essentially. So it was... it was essentially, there was peanut butter. I would have to like kind of,
well, you have me at peanut butter.
Bacon.
Yeah, yeah, right? I'm in.
Peanut butter, bacon, Maduros, which is like fried plantains. Really, really good flavors, like such a good sandwich. So that's one of the best things that I've had in months, at Auto Seattle. Shout out to Eric Rivera. And then I was just on Shag and Flies last night, and I was telling them about Hood Famous, which is a Filipino cafe. Like 90% of their products are like Filipino influenced. Some are just like Vietnamese coffee, but super good. One of the owners is the MC from Blue Scholars, the rap group. And it's just... it's a super cool place, and the food and drinks are incredible.
That sounds amazing. One of the things that I don't get living out here in the suburbs of Connecticut is that sort of thing. And I definitely miss hopping on the train going into New York or driving up to Boston or hanging out in the cities and having access to that kind of stuff. Alex, I know you have a lot of local favorites in your neighborhood. Why don't you talk to us about one thing you love, and then we'll get into our number of the week.
So this is a really fun one that I got to go to recently. I went to Comet Ping Pong in Northwest DC and had pizza and wings recently. Comet Ping Pong is known for many reasons that have nothing to do with food. And I'll let those of y'all Google that in case you're curious. But their single-story building without a basement has excellent wings and really, really good pizza also. So I really enjoyed my time there.
Made me
that
hungry.
Sounds good. I was just going to say, I need to order some delivery while we're recording this thing. all right, we're going to transition into our first segment. We do this every week, our number of the week, and I'm going to throw this out there. We're going to talk about Vlad Guerrero's ADP. The number right now is about 53. Specifically, when I looked it up, it was 53.19 for that, you know, that 0.19 of a person, wherever that draft is. And, you know, I want to bring this up because, yeah, Alex, that's Alex. I want to bring this up because I feel like a lot of people are split on Vlad, not so much because of maybe his potential or his previous performance, but because of the price tag. And what you might or might not be getting. So I don't care who we start with here. We did rock, paper, scissors last time, Mikey, when we had Scott Chu on, which was really a great visual for a podcast. So you can decide who wants to jump in first here on this, but how are we feeling on Vlad Guerrero's ADP relative to the risk versus the reward?
So you go.
Oh, all right. No, it's supposed to be you.
You're up.
We're really good at doing visual things. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so I'm just looking at like the auction values through the Bat X, and kind of what I was thinking about is Vlad has a little bit of, I don't know if prospect fatigue is necessarily the right term, because he's been good, but he just hasn't been the player that people envision when they think Wander Franco or Vlad Guerrero Jr. And just in like filtering by ADP, he, aside like outside of the positional adjustment, which I don't really take into account, he's worth like $13, which is like double of Aaron Judge, who's being picked right above him, and more than Starling Marte. So I think he is probably going a few picks later than he should be, especially because first base is kind of a tough position to draft. So like if, if Pete Alonso and Vlad were going back to back, which they are, going really close together, without looking at the numbers, I think I would probably just go Alonso because of his team. But I think Vlad's probably the better hitter. I'd have to look.
All right, I'm gonna push you to something quick before Alex jumps in and say, if he only does what he's done, are you still in the same camp?
I think you're right. Like, definitely some of it is that he has room to grow. If he is what he is, then I would take Pete Alonso. I am expecting him to get better. I think it'd be kind of crazy if he didn't continue to get better as a 22-year-old. And I do think that the trimming down, it could help him in terms of just like staying on the field. And hey, maybe it helps him get out in front of balls in front of the plate more, and he lifts balls some more. But
best shape of his life that actually does matter.
Yeah. I think he's gonna end up being maybe not the player that we think he is, but I think he's more of a 130 WRC plus player than the like 110 he's been.
All right, and Alex, where do you land on all this?
It's interesting that you bring up the team context there, because I sort of think that divisional context might be the thing that gets Vladimir Guerrero Jr. onto a team of mine this year. I think that the AL East is going to, I don't know, I think it's going to be a video game this year. Like, there's just nobody good in that division. I think I was looking through by, I mean, I think ADP lies here because Glasnow goes before Ryu, but I would call Hyunjin Ryu like the second best pitcher in the AL East, which is not a dig on him, but it is indicative of, like, in your mind, you're cataloging and you're like, oh, that's where we are now. Because, like, pretty much all of that Rays staff that we would, you know, brag about is gone. You know, the Yankees have Gerrit Cole, and they hope to get Luis Severino back for half of a season, basically. The Red Sox basically hope to have Sale back next year, and we'll let him pitch this year, incidentally. And like, you see where this is going.
Yeah.
It's also the case that a lot of these parks are pretty friendly. Now, they're not as friendly necessarily for righties, but, like, we don't know how that stadium down in Florida is going to play for the non-Toronto Blue Jays, but God, I just cannot imagine a world where, like, I want to be a starting pitcher in that division. Mm-hmm. Simply just because, like, one, all the hitters are so good. But, like, mm-hmm. think about it the other way. If you're a starting pitcher in that division, you probably got some job security. So I guess I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So let's get back to this. Would you want to be a starting pitcher facing Vlad Guerrero Jr. this year?
Basically, the way I'm thinking about it is, like, he's been really good about making contact overall. He's been really good about hitting the ball hard overall. He's going to have more teammates on base than he has previously had. If he just stops grounding out even a little bit, mm-hmm. He's going to be really good. And that's, like, it's crazy to think, like, we talk about some guys who, like, you know, the case where things go right versus the case where things go wrong are really wild and crazy. But for Vladito, it's so, so thin. It's just like, does he make this change? Does something different happen from, like, his swing plane at all? And yeah, I have to think the answer is yes. Like, there's literally, like, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars riding on that question.
Yeah, no pressure. Yeah, no pressure, Vlad, if you're listening, and I hope you are.
Yo, I mean, not just from him, though, you know, like, organizationally.
Yeah.
The Jays stand to make a huge amount of money if he's someone that people want to buy tickets to watch play baseball. So I kind of think that he'll figure it out.
Do you think that...
Just a hunch.
And again, I'll throw this out to both of you. Do you think that this is maybe like a case study for why we need to maybe tone down the hype on the kids in the minors? I almost feel like if he was just kind of came out of nowhere, everybody would be jazzed to have Vlad. And then he's suffering yeah. significantly from almost unrealistic expectations of what he was going to be at the major league level. Where do you guys stand on kind of that element?
I mean, I definitely think it's a bummer. Like, he's been, well, he hasn't been a very good fielder, but it's not his fault that the Blue Jays threw him over at third base. You know, he's been a slightly above average hitter. He's not a great runner, and he doesn't play great defense, but I actually think he might be like a good fit at first base. So this might be the year. I mean, it says like he is projected for 3-ish WAR. I don't know how the projection systems, I don't know how they bake in certain factors. Like I know the BatX takes a lot of Statcast into account. Do they take into account that he grounds, like he puts the ball on the ground a lot? Because if they're just looking solely at his batted ball data, they're going to be pretty badly misled, but it looks like all of the projection systems like him plenty fine. So yeah, I really wish that we would stop doing this to players because it really does them a disservice.
I will say a thing that I'm noticing recently with BatX is that they tend to really love a couple guys who have really high barrel numbers, but like have some wonky barrel numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell like what the inputs probably are going to look like. So like Nick Castellanos, who tends to barrel the ball a lot, but not exceptionally super barrel it, but also barrel it to center, which is a really good way to hit doubles and flyouts, not home runs,
yeah.
Is rated really highly in the home run projections from BatX. And you can tell that's just a place where their model is choosing not to include slightly more levels of factors in order to keep the predictiveness up. Because when you just add in more gunk to those prediction machines, they don't necessarily get better. You introduce more ways for them to be fuzzy, mm-hmm. not necessarily more ways for them to figure out a guy, right? So, you know, like, I imagine for someone like him who's got... problems getting barrels despite his really high like hard hit rate sort of data, there's probably some way that they're accounting for that,
mm-hmm.
but it's really hard to incorporate directionality, and like at some point, you know, the gains in accuracy like going backwards don't outweigh the gains in accuracy going forwards. You just kind of take what you can get,
right?
Yeah, well, I think that this is going to be a big year to see. You know, I think there is something to the best shape of his life. It seems as though he really made a significant effort, and that the improvement started at the end of last year, and there was a correlation between his weight loss and his on-field performance. So I want to see good things. I can say that with certainty. I want good things for the kid. I think he'd be a very exciting player for the league. You know, they probably would mismanage that and not capitalize on it the way that they should. But I think he'd be very exciting young guy to see for, you know, the next 10, 15 years. All right, let's transition into our central question of the episode. This one's called Just How to Be Right. We have a kind of our series about how to be right about specific things. And this one, we're going to talk a little bit more broadly about things in general. You know, here at Dugout Study Hall, we're not the kind of pod that's going to do positional previews. So this is kind of as close as we're going to get. We're going to talk a little bit strategy. We're going to talk a little bit about players. But what we're really trying to get at is where can I be right in my drafts where my league mates may go wrong? Or how can I avoid being the one who goes wrong? And I guess we'll start with strategy. And Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you first. You recently participated in a TGFBI draft. So maybe talk to us a little bit about that, and we can segue into, you know, what was it that went right? What was it that went wrong? Who kind of fell to you? How did it all work out in ways that you're happy and in ways that maybe you wish it had gone a little differently?
I saw a tweet from, there's two tweets. It's one is Alex Chamberlain saying something about, and I can't remember the exact verbiage, but he essentially was like, the takeaway is like, everyone loves their team in the first 12 picks. And after that, like, you know,
I remember this one. Yeah. It's like everyone loves their team after 2 picks and everyone hates their team after 12 picks.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's something like that.
And so I loved my team. Like I started off with Story and I picked down the 13th spot. Story, Bellinger, Maeda, Springer, Hendricks. And I could not have been more thrilled. Like I got a pretty good power speed blend. I'm not sacrificing averages. I love Kenta Maeda as I like to call them glue guys, but with some strikeouts. Yeah. And then Kyle Hendricks, who's a glue guy with, you know, fewer strikeouts. So for me, it was just kind of smooth sailing for a long time. I got Ketel Marte. I got Jeff McNeil at like around 100, which I felt like was criminal. I don't know why. Yeah. Especially if you want average. He's a second baseman.
Yeah.
Like, it's so tough to find these guys. I wasn't planning on taking Ketel Marte and Jeff McNeil back to back, but I was willing to do it. And I think that's where things started to get a little more interesting. Like, I took Kenley Jansen after that, which, like, I wasn't thrilled about, but who's really thrilled about taking any closer ever? Tyler Molly, Josh Bell, Gio Urshela. I feel like one of my weirdest picks, and I've been talking to Chase.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. Once we got into, you know, like the 12th round, actually. So like the 12th round and after. Devin Williams, I wasn't sure. Like I made it a really big emphasis this year to, even if guys are falling, it's not about getting the best values. It's about creating the best team. Mm-hmm. And so, like, in that Kenley Jansen spot, I really, really wanted to get Joe Musgrove. But in my head, I was thinking, you know, I already have Maeda. I already have Hendricks. I don't need him. Mm-hmm. I do want a closer that I deem like a stud, like a guy that's going to keep his job, is going to, you know, put up solid numbers. And I think Kenley is that guy, even if he's sitting at 90.
And there's so few, you know, of them in the league, especially the way things are now. Yeah.
Plus, he's keeping a good job, which is like something to be said.
That's a good point. And I was comfortable doing that. Like, one thing in this draft is I didn't even really have to get like Hendricks. I don't feel like maybe if I didn't take Hendricks, I could have taken Musgrove later, but I'm just, once I have a foundation of any sort, I'm pretty comfortable getting pitching later. And I waited a long time. Like, I got Maeda, I got Hendricks, and then I got Tyler Molly at 133. I set the minimum at that, and then someone else took him at 126. The audacity.
Copying you, clearly.
Yeah, so I didn't get another starting pitcher until the 19th round in Matthew Boyd. And maybe people think I'm crazy, but at that point, for me, it was, I'm chasing that K-minus walk percentage, hoping the home runs go down. And even if they don't, I have Hendricks, I have Maeda. And then I kind of followed it up with someone sort of similar, and Yusei Kikuchi, who has some warts, but I think can be, like, legitimately a top 20 pitcher, like an ace. And then Lindblom. So I've got a really weird starting pitching group, and this is actually kind of reminding me that I probably need to take another. I do want to know, like, I am unsure how many starters and relievers to go. I want to know if you guys have any input there, because I have four picks left.
So, like, I think this kind of, like, starts to open up the can of worms that, like, I'm interested in. Like, when I, you know, I guess I didn't have to twist your ear to get you here, but, like, I'd like to believe it. Which is, like, you know, like, how a particular sort of league changes the way that you're going to feel about things. Because you're going to set your lineups for pitching once a week in TGFBI. Mm-hmm. And same thing for NFBC. And I think that weekly leagues are dumb, and I hate them, but I also understand that if you want to get a bunch of quote-unquote industry, quote-unquote, again, professionals to draft people, that you got to be a little bit lenient about these sort of things so that they don't just, you know, like, all not want to do it. So I'm assuming, what, you're going to have something like, how many pitching spots do you have? Is it nine?
Yeah.
It's nine? Yeah, and, like, I don't know. If you don't feel like that third reliever is actually going to be, like, adding something, and I think that most of the time I'd probably be expecting to start six starting pitchers, right? So, like, how many more than six starting pitchers do you currently own?
I don't know. Let's see. One, two, three, four, five. I have six. So,
and how many relievers do you have?
Three.
Yeah, I'd probably pick up another starter and maybe roster eight starting pitchers if you really feel like you want to own a guy. But the thing is, like, you know, it's a question of, like, what your bench does for you in weekly leagues, right? And this is, like, one of the big projects that I took on shortly after I started applying to pitcher lists, actually, before I got even, like, hired by Nick, was starting to fix, like, how we draft for daily lineup leagues versus weekly lineup leagues. And slowly it became, like, a more broad, like, FanGraphs calculator is broken, sort of, like, rambling into the void at, like, 3 in the morning. But, like, there definitely is, like, a very big under consideration for, like, how format is going to change the way that you approach things beyond just, like, number of teams and stuff like that. So, like, you know, in your case, people on your bench are going to sit on your bench for the most part. So you can afford to kind of, like, handcuff and afford to do things like, you know, like, roster flyers, like, prospects a lot more than you would either. Or, like, in, like, daily leagues, you know, even, like, we're drafting for a couple leagues I'm in that are going to be a Yahoo daily head-to-head. So you, like, only get 7 moves a week, and then you flip, like, move people around. So you need, like, a bajillion extra pitchers on your bench there because, like, you just want to, like, float them in and out of your lineup. But I imagine in your case, that's not the case. You just, like, want to grab people that you want to own. So, like,
and I mean, like, on the board, speaking of handcuffs, like, Trinan's there. There's Britton. There is Stamont and Bummer and Pagan. So I feel like between them, I probably should grab another reliever. And I feel like the person that's most likely to actually get that spot is actually someone that you referred to me in Stamont.
Yeah, I think that he's, like, an interesting, like, pseudo-handcuff, pseudo-dude to just stick in your lineup whenever you don't have, like, a good two-start guy at the end of your week. Like, in all likelihood, you're going to have to pick up, like, a starting pitcher or two of the waiver wire at some point. You know, the guys you're drafting aren't going to be the guys you have all year. But the nice thing about Stamont is if he's occupying a roster spot, you know, I wouldn't feel terrible. It's kind of terrible about cutting him loose or anything. But also, like, in the event that, like, you just don't like a matchup, like, throwing him into your lineup is gonna help you out in the long run. Like, he's gonna get you some ratios help. He's gonna get you some strikeouts. Depending on situation, he could be a closer pretty quickly too. So it's a sort of, like, win-win, just keep your team okay sort of guy that doesn't make your life harder.
I think that's that's something that maybe doesn't get talked about all that much is the relief pitchers that have those good ratios that are phenomenal setup guys. In today's game, they could very easily become a closer or at least pick up saves for you in an off week. And if you're the guy who has that person and you don't have to go to the waiver wire to get them, when that change happens, that's a huge advantage.
Yeah. And man, so I was really wanting to get like guys like Hector Neris and like Amir Garrett or, you know, maybe someone with more job security. But that's kind of why I took Devin Williams earlier, is because he is going to give me super, super, super quality innings. And I saw a tweet from like Rob DiPietro, and he was essentially like, I don't understand why we believe in Devin Williams at all. Like, he was not even good in 2019. And I replied and I was like, these are the two super simple reasons. His changeup is way different. He gets like 10 more inches of depth, and he started throwing it way more. But Hader isn't like, he gives up a lot of home runs, and he also walks a good amount of hitters. So it's not like he's like super secure in his job, I don't think.
He's also left-handed, right? This is like a weird random thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much a council cares about that, but it just in that regard, like, they should realistically not have a closer in that bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
They should have a platoon that matches 100%. To like who's up, and it shouldn't even be about leverage. They're both, in my mind, equally capable of handling the last three innings or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Council's doing his job right, those guys are going to mix and match. Sometimes one of them will be the closer, and like the move towards leagues without saves has to happen because the move towards good baseball is abandoning saves, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, managers don't care about your fantasy team. They care about wins and losses on the field. And
thank God.
yeah, sure, of course. But in terms of like closer and how volatile it is, it's just so hard to try and build a strategy around it that you can have any kind of faith in, even those guys at the top. So I, on one hand, if you can be one of the guys that grabs one of those top five, right, and you have that that safety net, somebody like Jansen, like you were talking about, you know, there's so few like that. But if it's going to be a category and you have the closer in waiting who on a down week, you can still throw in and get good ratios and pick up a few Ks. I do think that that's a good way to go with those extra relief pitcher slots at the end of a draft.
For sure.
I want to flip like a little bit of an expansion of this question. We're kind of on to you, and that's like, if there's anyone else on your roster that you feel like you took here just because of TGFBI, whether that's because like are you trying to win the overall? Do you care about that?
I am definitely building my team to try my best. And I mean, I'm not going to win the overall. I am trying to, I also said this earlier today, I'm trying to break the top 100.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
And even then, I'm not even sure that that's going to be a thing, but I am going to try my darndest.
Yeah. Cool. So, like, I'm wondering if there's anyone else on your roster that you feel like you would not otherwise own, but, you know, you have because of format.
Like, I'm not super thrilled about Adam Eaton being in my utility spot.
That's a dude. I've heard of him.
Yeah. So, like, in like points, there's absolutely no way Adam Eaton would be on my team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. A weird Adam Eaton thing. One of the last actual real baseball games I went to was a Nats game in like peak Baby Shark era.
Oh no!
It was a lot of fun. And in like the
spoken like somebody who doesn't have a toddler running around the house singing it 24/7.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Bring it back. Yeah. Like in the bottom of the first, like before he comes up to bat the first time, like one of their TV people like pulls some random guy out of the audience or the crowd. It's a crowd. And is like, yeah, like predict who's going to hit the first home run of the game. And the dude of all Washington Nationals players picks Adam Eaton, and he homers in the first.
No
he's
way.
He's got the almanac from Back to the Future. That's cheating.
Wow.
Yeah. So he got a signed bat. It was super cool to see, but also just like as someone who has maybe watched any baseball at all, I was just like in absolute disbelief.
I mean,
I feel like I've seen some really weird things in Nats games.
That's like a full court shot from a fan. Like that's. Yeah.
Feels like it that's happens all the there. Time because we always see it on TV, but it's so rare, right?
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about the strategy that you used, the format specific stuff, especially that goes along with TGFBI. Let's move into some players. And Mikey, here, I'm going to give you the floor to kind of pick the guys you want to talk about most, and we can go in any direction that you want. Especially those people who might, you know, either be like, nah, I don't want that guy. I've had him before. He burned me. Or, oh, that guy's too old. Or, you know, I don't know. This he's ranked 350th, but you kind of believe he's going to way outperform that rank or the ADP.
I think we have to talk about Tyler Molly here. This is like the thing you're begging for.
Yeah. Okay, we can talk about that first. Obviously, I did set the min on Tyler Molly. And I like him a lot because I think, so first of all, his walk percentage was like 10% last year, and that's not going to hold. A guy that has that good of command with that good of a fastball, like that's just not going to happen again. I think that he has a chance to be something like, I wouldn't be shocked at all if his K minus walk percentage was like 23.
That's good for those y'all at home. Yeah.
Yeah.
20 is usually the line for like a guy that you can just count on and set it and forget it.
I think he can probably hold like a 30% strike percentage or a strikeout percentage, like a 7% walk percentage, and not really have a home run issue relative to other pitchers. I wrote him up. I really like him because, I mean, A, he has job security. He's like their number three starting pitcher. Mm-hmm. But also, he added a ton of ride to his fastball. And again, for those of you listening at home, that just means his fastball is sort of like vertically straighter now. It drops less. Yeah, it gives the illusion of like a rise to hitters, so it's harder to barrel up, essentially.
It kind also of like messes lifts. With timing, I think, because like the lack of movement according to your like based on your expectations makes it look like it's like not going as fast as it actually is, so mm-hmm. it like has a bit of an optical trick.
Hey, Mikey, can I ask a question about that? Is that related to throwing harder, or is that more related to like a spin rate?
So it's two things. One, you'll find a pretty strong correlation between velocity. Well, I wouldn't even say like a strong correlation, but basically like if you throw harder, you're going to throw with better ride unless you have a pretty extreme like access of your fastball. So like Tyler Molly has a super good active spin or spin efficiency. Mm-hmm. It's like nearly 100%. I think at some point in 2020 it was 100%. So he spins it perfectly with perfect backspin nearly.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think that we got to make sure we say there. It's like almost if you're dealing with like a pool shot and you mm-hmm. hit the ball in such a way that like it's not going to spin at all when it like ricochets off. It's just mm-hmm. straight up and down movement, basically, mm-hmm. right?
Right. And so that just sets up a lot. Like if you have a good fastball, you don't need to do that much else. Like Brandon Woodruff is really good and has a really, really obscenely good fastball. His other pitches aren't that great. He just can throw his fastball a ton because it has a 17% swinging strike percentage, which probably won't hold in 2021, but it's still pretty good, and he'll still have a pretty good one. So Tyler Molly is like, he might be like my number one guy I'm betting on. Like, I think probably, I mean, I set them in on him. Yeah. So at 133, I think he is the guy that I'm betting on. I mean, I think the other guys that I'm kind of gravitating towards are guys that people don't like because they're old. Buster Posey is one of those guys. I don't think there's any reason he should be going at like 250 when a lot of guys like him are going at like 180. Mm-hmm. So Buster Posey is one of my main targets. I got him in TGFBI. I double tapped and went Danny Jansen right after him.
Happy you did that.
Yeah, I was I mean, that was another Chase referral. He was a guy that I was looking at, but not like a guy that I was specifically like, I need that guy. Justin Upton is another fantastic example. And not only is he, you know, someone who is we're just biased against because he's old, but he also made some tweaks to his mechanics late last season and just raked. So his numbers look really bad for 2020, but he's pretty good and actually like might contribute some stolen bases too. I suppose the pitching version of these guys, even though he's not old, he's like
he kind of pitches like, I don't know, if I was like, Josh Lindblom is 37, you'd be like, yeah. I'm super into Lindblom. Like, I have him at like 76 in my rankings or something like that. What is he doing? He is adding spin efficiency to his fastball. He made it like a huge emphasis this offseason, and he went from, I think he raised it like 20%, which is really, really significant. Yeah, Lindblom, not only is he, did he add a lot of spin efficiency to his fastball, but I think he might have been working on a pitch or something like that. It seems like everyone is adding a split change this offseason. Like, there are at least half a dozen pitchers that have done so and that I approve of doing so, but it's kind of, you know, it makes you nervous too.
Well, if everybody's doing it, it's harder to tell who's doing it and it'll make a difference, right?
Right. I feel like if you guys have ever played like Out of the Park and you're like, I just want my two pitch guy to develop a changeup, it's like, all right,
yeah,
good luck. It's actually going to be any good.
Yeah, it's not going to be a good changeup or an effective changeup. While we're kind of talking a little bit about spin efficiency, I think this is an important thing that I came across. So if the two of you could speak to it, because I think you probably understand it on a different level than even I do. But it was really interesting about the spin efficiency, not only helping to keep it on plane, right? If it's 100%, it's more likely to go straight, but it affects drop as well. And so, if you are throwing the ball at 94, but you have a really high spin rate and spin efficiency, it's going to drop at a level that's equal to somebody throwing, say, and I'm making this number up, but 97 mm-hmm. or 98. So velocity is not the only part of the story. And I only bring it mm-hmm. up because I know a lot of people who are looking for these kinds of things are going to like FanGraphs and Savant, and they're looking at numbers like, how hard does this guy throw the ball, right? But that factor is really important, because if you're only throwing 94, but you've got that going on, you're going to be more effective, right?
Right. And I will say it's not the only way to have a good fastball. Like, Jacob DeGrom, and obviously he throws like 97, 98, whatever. But even when he didn't have that velo, he has a lot of gyro on his fastball. Like, he does not throw a Gerrit Cole fastball. But yeah, it's definitely something that like really needs to be taken into account. And I mean, really, there are a lot of different ways to look at this kind of thing. Like, you can just look at, let's say, like vertical movement on fastball, which is often what I'll do on Brooks Baseball. Mm-hmm. I'll go and I'm basically looking like, does this guy have vertical movement that's like 9 inches or up? And if he does, that means he has pretty good ride on his fastball. So
like, nine's your number you're looking for?
A lot of the time. I mean, if a certain pitcher has like 8.5, like if they throw hard, I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But so, you know, like there's no clear cut way to kind of do it. But I was looking at one point to try, and obviously like pitchers like DeGrom foiled this, but I was trying to see like, can we just literally take spin rate and multiply it by active spin rate and like get kind of a true spin rate. And the R squared for, I think, swinging strike percentage was like fine. Like, it was about as good as like, normal spin rate, but obviously, it is just like philosophically flawed.
It's kind of weird. Like, I want to like go into the weeds on this stats thing and then kind of just try to exit back into reality.
Before we jump too far down, Alex, could you just and I'm going to leave you to do your thing, but could we just explain R squared? It's something that's thrown around a lot.
That's actually where I was going to go with
perfect,
this.
Because I think we hear it a lot, but I don't know if everybody quite understands what that means.
Yeah, so I actually want to make sure that I say a lot of people who do statistical regression do not know what they are doing with statistical regression, and that can lead to some really weird stuff. Basically, the R squared is a measure of the amount of like correlation, and what that means is like, how often does this one thing predict another thing successfully? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily like future, just like, if I know someone's height, do I also know their gene size or something like right. that. If I know that someone eats Taco Bell 4 times a week, do I happen to know, Mikey, I'm not attacking you here.
Getting personal here on the pod.
Yeah. So like that's like one of a couple different ways that we'll like measure correlation. Something that's like closer to zero is going to be less. Something that's closer to 100 is going to be more. And depending on the field that you're in and what you're trying to measure, you're going to have different benchmarks that are good. So when Mikey says that like something about R squared with this particular thing, you just got to find a good thing to compare it to. So like I think that his like true spin rate thingy, when you go plug that into a technical term,
the thingy,
yes, of course. yeah you go ahead and plug that into your statistical whatever. You just want to know, like, am I getting better predictivity of a thing that I think this thing would reasonably help me predict if I make this change? We could probably do a longer episode where I just complain about people who don't know how to do correlation, doing correlation and thinking they're doing research. Because a lot of the time, I don't think it's actually their fault. I think statistics education is just awful. Yeah. All of the statistics that I know and use, I have taught myself through online textbooks for the most part and through YouTube videos, not through any of the classes that I actually took and paid money to learn statistics in. But I also have taught math before, so like there's definitely also some aptitude bits there. So a lot of people don't have to have a good statistics class to go like learn how to do statistics well. Mm-hmm. We talk frequently on the show about how you just want to make sure that there isn't an opportunity for your numbers to be lying to you. A lot of people will try to improve R squared, but they won't actually get at why the number would be flawed, why two things would not be related to each other, and try to fix that in their correlations.
Well, I would also
let's probably kill this conversation.
I think you could theoretically have two things that have a really good R squared, but are just coincidental, right? Like, causal. Okay. And that's another thing to just consider.
Yeah, that's called p-hacking. that's a thing. Or maybe there's just covariance, basically. It's not causal, right? It's just like there's a lurking variable that's causing it. It's like to talk about things like often like people don't take into account childhood poverty rates whenever they try to correlate like childhood education and spending. Well, it's like, are you spending your money well? Are there other things that are going to depend on, or they're going to influence outcomes that have nothing to do with the amount that you're spending?
Well, just right? like with so, anything else that's statistical, right? If you cherry pick and if you have an end game in mind, you could probably find a path there, right? Get back to players, there's one, Mikey, if you would indulge me, that I'd like to hear you talk about, because I think this is somebody that you're in on and that you've done some talking about, and that's Dylan Moore. You want to go ahead and talk to us about how you feel about Dylan Moore?
Let's go. So I don't know. I will say that I have kind of tempered my a little bit of my love for Dylan Moore because of his batting average, and I think even as a good hitter, I think it's, you know, it's something that probably peaks at like 250 or 260. But I do really like Dylan Moore because he's going to steal more than almost anyone who isn't like Alberto or what is
Adalberto
it?
Alberto Mondesi.
Adalberto.
Ah, that's what it is. Mondesi or like Trey Turner. And so it's looking like he's going to go potentially like 20-25 with obviously good power. Decent batting average, like he's not Miguel Sano, and perhaps the key is that he plays multiple positions. He can play second base, he can play outfield. I mean, he could get eligibility elsewhere. So he was one of my main targets going in, but I think like as a smart drafter, when I got Ketel Marte, got Jeff McNeil, I could have taken him. Like he was a guy that I wanted going in. But it didn't make any sense for me, even though I really wanted those steals.
Can I talk to you about a thing that scares me about him really quickly, just because I am obligated to?
Please.
Dylan Moore had a 35% line drive rate last year. And that scares me because I know that nobody sustains a 35% line drive rate whose name doesn't rhyme with Petty Preeman. So
yeah,
even Freeman's like just an anomaly. So like I have a lot of doubts about his ability to hit well enough to stay in the lineup if that regresses hard, because he's, you know, not striking out a small amount of the time. And I mean, the walks are nice, but you know, if we see him being like a, you know, like around a 30% strikeout guy with, like, you know, just high single digit walk rate, his on base percentage probably is going to dip towards 300, which is usually a scary number for people. So do you have particular insights about him as a batter that are more refined than my this number going to regress approach?
Yeah, I mean, I do. One thing that I'll say, I did write him up at Lookout Landing, and I'll say that there's probably a part of me that wants this to be real, even though I did it through a somewhat objective analytical lens. He cut his K percentage 6 points, or 6%. He upped his max exit velo by 3 points. He upped his dynamic hard hit rate by 5 points. Obviously, this is in a small sample size, but his launch angle tightness was good. He changed his mechanics. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I don't think that projections are going to be able to catch that, but I think that also, I think the projections, you know, he didn't do it for that long. So
yeah, that's always going to be a reason why they're going to doubt it. Right.
Right. Yeah. So I actually kind of like him over, Kyle Lewis as a hitter right now, and they're going in the same area, but he is, you know, he has a lot more steals. One thing is that he only hit fastballs. He was in the 95th percentile in ex-woba against fastballs, 6th percentile in ex-woba against off-speed and breaking, which, you know, matters Serrano. And doesn't matter. Yeah. I mean, pitchers already kind of adjusted. There's not much more that they can just not throw fastballs. We did see kind of a spike in zone percentage towards the end of the year, but his eye isn't bad. It's just, you know, he swings hard. So I don't know. It does kind of smell a little bit like, a flash in the pan. I mean, when you just kind of look at him, he doesn't have the look of the player that he was in 2020. I don't know how to describe it, but
does it give you like Danny Santana vibes, or does it give you like something that is not Danny Santana vibes?
I've heard that before, and I don't really like the, I don't get that. So yeah, there's definitely some legitimate changes that took place. I will say, to your point about staying in the lineup, I don't think there's any chance he loses. Okay. I mean, he might lose a couple plate appearances, but he can play so many places that at the very least he's just going to move around more. So
yeah, because like I'm thinking about this from like a you know, there's so many different ways to be right or wrong about a guy, right? And this is kind of where I want to take this direction, or where I want to find a nope, that's not the words either. This is kind of the direction that I want to try to like lead out of this with, is that, you know, when we're trying to put this all together, we have opinions about guys that we're willing to take when they're falling relative to everyone else, guys that we're going to be really high on, or guys where like we just kind of agree with everyone else that they're good. And like that doesn't mean you'll always get them, but you're just like, yeah, this other guy got him, and I think that was a good pick for him. Yeah. And I'm kind of curious about what it is that you think you are maybe doing differently from people who are drafting, or like looking at players that like tends to separate you from the crowd, and maybe also like what sort of blind spots you might have.
Historically, I mean, in the past, I used to be like, especially when I was just playing in home leagues and wasn't like writing for pitcher lists, I used to be really bad about playing to my format and just like picking good players, which is good, but it's not good for fantasy baseball. I mean, and looking at my draft board, I think a lot of it is I feel like I kind of draft differently from a lot of people. And I get my guys. Like, I never really draft guys that I don't like a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Springer's a pretty good example of someone that, like, I don't love him. I like him as a player, but, like there aren't that many times when I draft someone, I'm like, I don't really actually like them. The only time is when I need to make up a category. But pretty early on, I made sure to give myself a floor of, like I said, like the power speed blend. And I went Maeda and Hendricks right away. Oh, not even really right away, like in the first five rounds, because I wanted to just have guys that people kind of consider like blah, but they give me the ability to draft Matt Boyd and Kikuchi and probably another high
bet on the upside guy, because you've already got your floor built in.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like you know that you're not winning the draft in the first five rounds. Nobody wins the draft in the first right. five rounds. Mm-hmm. That's why everyone's happy with their team. You'll lose when someone gets hurt, but otherwise, like, the only thing that's going to separate you from the rest of the pack and, like, the other people in the other TGFBI leagues who drafted the exact same five guys by rule mm-hmm. of dice is that you're doing some crazy stuff later on relative to the field. I think you seem to know that, and I don't yeah. think a lot of people seem to know that, like, what their victory condition is. Mm-hmm. Now, like, realistically speaking, as you look towards, like, this, what sort of, like, things do you feel like do you worry about with this team, and kind of like your things in general, that like, what kind of risks on players are you making in this draft, maybe more than elsewhere?
I think one thing that I didn't say is that I don't draft, like, rookies. Like, I'm not going to draft Jared Kelnick. I'm not going to draft, like, even, like, second-year players. A lot of the time, there's too much helium. There's mm-hmm. not enough reason to rely on them. Like, why would I do that when I could just take, I don't know, Brian Anderson, who's super vanilla, but, like, plays a ton and is good. So, I mean, really, I think the only thing is just over betting on my ability to find pitching on my own, because I really like, you know, to wait for starting pitching from, I guess I took Molly in the ninth round, but I waited for nine more rounds. Mm. And I only took one other pitcher in between then. So really, for this to fall apart, I am betting a lot on Maeda and Hendricks to be my glue guys, but I'm pretty confident in them. I honestly, like, I don't think there are that many ways in which my team's flawed. Sounds
famous last feels, words.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what you should. You if you've done it right according to your plan, if you've executed against what you're trying to do, and adapted in the way that you need to adapt as the draft unfolds, you should kind of feel that way at the end of a draft. 2 weeks into the mm-hmm. season, maybe not so much, right? Depending upon yeah. how things shape up. But you really should leave the draft feeling a sense of confidence.
Right. And, I mean, if you look at my team projections, like, I'm going to pull them up right now, they're not that great. Like, so my hitting's super green for the first three cats, which are home runs, runs, RBIs.
Mm-hmm. No, I want to, like, make sure I come back to that. Like, are those categories you always want to be winning, like, strategically?
I just know that I always inevitably end up with a pretty, like, I hate taking guys like Sano. Like, I almost did, and I almost took Gallo, but I probably just have flaws in terms of guys that I just don't like, and I just won't really take them. Like, it used to be, I think a good example is Eddie Rosario. Mm-hmm. Super good player, yep. Like, super, super solid in fantasy, but I just have some weird bias against him. So not necessarily, it's just kind of how it all,
yeah. I ask because I do try to actively win those three categories with every team. Like, yeah. I want to make sure I'm in the top three on every single draft I'm doing there.
I mean, I try my best. Yeah. And so, I mean, in looking at my team, my weak spot is my pitching.
but that was intentional, which, it sounds like. It was part of your play.
Yeah.
Was to mm-hmm. bolster the offense, to have green for those offensive categories, and then have confidence yeah. in your ability to go grab guys throughout the season that are going to make up that difference. And that's that kind of bold move, Alex, that you were talking about before, where that's the way you separate. It's almost like a DFS kind of thing, right? Where you have to zig where other people zag if you're going to separate yourself from the crowd in a format where there is that overall contest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so really it's the saves where this can unravel, and probably just kind of betting on myself too much. I actually am pretty surprised at how green my offense is, because early, like, not that long ago, it wasn't that great.
yeah, I feel like a lot of those, like, how good is your team things, you know, they just count up how many you got. They don't really assess how much talent you have or how you're going
to
be on the field.
They also plan on that being your lineup for an entire year versus all the other teams' lineups being the same for the entire. I mean, it's a good gauge, but it certainly is not a predictor of outcome at the end of a year. And I don't want to end this conversation at all. And in fact, I think because of that, we're going to have you come back real, real soon, Mikey. But before we have to let you go, I want to shift gears here. We usually do a pass fail segment. We're going to skip that this week and move to off the books, which we haven't gotten to, in the past few episodes. And, I'm going to make you commissioner for the day of Major League Baseball, and you have the power to change one thing. And it will stick. What is the one thing that you would change first? What's the one thing that the MLB should be doing right now? A change to the game, a change to procedure, a change to anything. What would it be and why?
I would write the CBA myself. Does that count? Like, I feel like there are a lot of things, but I would just make the game more equitable. And if that is kind of like a... almost like a cop-out, I would just do things to make the game more fun. I don't even necessarily know that. Because, I mean, the issues, a lot of them aren't necessarily the game itself, but because I think people would say there's a pace of play issue, and I don't even necessarily think that, I mean, that it's even that bad.
Baseball's shorter than football by a lot.
Yeah, typical football game really... has like 11 minutes worth of actual action. I think it's just, it's that football happens once a week, so people are more patient with it. I think that's the only difference.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like the players can only be happier if there is a better, there's going to be a better product if the players are happier. The players are happier if they're getting compensated how they should, and it's not getting, just going to billionaires who don't need it as much. So I think that's probably the change that I would make, which is kind of admittedly a boring answer.
No, not at all.
Can I take your boring answer to 11?
You can always take things to 11.
I would force all of the teams to be sold and locally owned by fans, like the Green Bay Packers.
Co-ops.
Yeah. Or like the Bundesliga. Yeah, every team needs to become a co-op.
Is that a thing?
Like all of German soccer teams are required to be 50% owned by fans.
Well, what about the Packers? Is that a thing?
They have a board of directors, but technically they are owned by the city of Green Bay.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I would want Detroit to own the Detroit Tigers. I want the city of Baltimore to own the Orioles. It would keep them from ever moving. It would mean that all publicly funded things that go into the things are actually, just because they are wanted by people or whatever, and not because some person asked for a favor and then, threatened to move the team. public investment on youth leagues would be directly tied to things. It's such a more sustainable way to build sports is to make them publicly owned. Countries have decided they wanted to win a World Cup in soccer, and then they just start publicly investing in youth facilities and sports. It's good for people in a non-professional sports way too. So I'm very strongly opinionated about this being a perfect world thing. Of course,
we couldn't tell.
If I were
Alex,
made commissioner for the day, the owners determine who is the commissioner. So they would ransack my office with pitchforks that they had heated up in the fire first before they pitchforked me, so that I couldn't sign a rule like that. But that is the on 11 version of your
answer. That certainly is on 11. Go. It got a little weird there for a minute, but it's okay. We've come back. We're good. Mikey, thank you so much for being a part of this. It was a blast. We will have you back as soon as you are willing to come back and be a part of this. But before we sign off here on this episode, could you please let the people at home know all of the various places that they can find you? Plug your stuff, because it's great. And make sure you're listening carefully at home and follow everything he tells you to do right here.
So nice. So the first thing, before I say any of that, I'm going to say, make sure you get Mitch Haniger, Joe Musgrove, and Tyler Molly in your drafts. You can find my work at Lookout Landing and Pitcher List. You can find me on Twitter at DysyMikey, DysthyMikey. Apologies in advance for my tweets, but...
no way.
No.
No way.
I throw in some good baseball tweets in there every once in a while, so it's
one of the best follows out there. Make sure that you go and find that.
thanks for having me. I'm already excited to come back. I said that to Shagging Flies last night, but there's a reason why these were the two podcasts that I was really wanting to come guest on. So super happy to have done this.
We appreciate that very much. And, yeah, like this is great. And we're, like I said, I'm not just saying that because you're here and then we're going to sign off and be like, we're never having him back again.
Definitely.
Yeah. as soon as possible. All right. So that's going to wrap up this episode. Thank you at home for listening. Alex, thank you as always. And if you could go ahead and let the people know where they can find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.